This is Ryan Radecki, and this is the Emergency Medicine Literature of Note audio digest for the month of March. This is just an audio summary of some of the most interesting blog posts and articles that I reviewed last month relevant to emergency medicine and healthcare quality. Without further ado, as usual, I'll just get right into the articles and quickly talk about this first one, which is called Reduction in Time to Treatment in Pre-Hospital Telemedicine Evaluation and Thrombolysis. And this is from the Journal of Neurology, and this is all about mobile stroke units, which is where they put a CT scanner into an oversized ambulance and have some sort of stroke physician expertise along for the ride, and they go out on 911 calls to evaluate patients for possible stroke in the field with the interests of getting them their TPA before even arriving at the hospital. The stated hypothesis of this project is, quote-unquote, that the mobile stroke unit will allow significant reductions in time to evaluation and treatment of patients when compared to a traditional ambulance model in an American urban environment. And that pretty much goes without saying. I mean, if you take the TPA with you into the field, it's going to be faster than waiting for the patient to arrive at the hospital. Yet somehow they thought that that needed to be a testable hypothesis. And, you know, that's what they showed. This is a report of just the first 100 patients evaluated, generated by 317 system alerts. 33 patients were given a preliminary diagnosis of probable stroke, 30 were possibly stroke, 4 were transient ischemic attacks, 5 were intracerebral hemorrhages, and then there were 28 non-cerebrovascular diagnoses. Of those 33 probable strokes, 16 actually received thrombolysis, and as expected, by most of their metrics, they got their TPA about 20 to 40 minutes faster than they otherwise would have if they had gone to the hospital. Unfortunately, they don't really give us any safety information or confirmatory information like follow-up MRI to see that they didn't give it to a stroke mimic. We're just supposed to expect that this faster is better, you know, because quote-unquote time is brain, and that using telemedicine for this diagnosis without actually having a physician evaluate the patient in person is just as safe and effective as it otherwise would have been. I would say there was one little interesting tidbit from this paper, at least, that was potentially relevant to these sorts of pre-hospital stroke evaluations, is that one of the 5 patients with an intracerebral hemorrhage was actually on anticoagulation, and they were able to start their prothrombin concentrate complexes before reaching the hospital, which, in theory, should reduce their hemorrhage size and potentially improve their outcome down the road. But otherwise, this is just adding to the body of literature that says, yeah, I mean, if you give somebody a medicine in an ambulance before they get to the hospital, it's faster than doing it when they get to the hospital. And they haven't proven anything about improved outcomes or safety or reliability, and they haven't validated their telemedicine model particularly in any fashion. And the next one is called Hydrocortisone, Vitamin C, and Thiamine for the Treatment of Severe Sepsis and Septic Shock, a Retrospective Before-After Study. And this is in CHEST. And this study, I'm not going to call it nuts by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm going to call it profoundly overhyped. Because this is just a before and after study at a single center where they had practice change in an intensive care unit where their approach to severe sepsis was altered to include a protocol featuring intravenous high-dose vitamin C, 1.5 grams Q6, intravenous thiamine, 200 milligrams Q12, and hydrocortisone, 50 milligrams Q6. Essentially, this institution and this author, the lead author, hypothesized that this combination might have some sort of beneficial physiologic effect, and after witnessing some initial anecdotal improvement in their first couple patients, switched to this aforementioned protocol. And they report their in-hospital mortality for patients treated on this new protocol is 8.5%, whereas previously treated patients were 40.4%. Vasopressor use and acute kidney injury was similarly curtailed in the treatment group. But that said, these miraculous findings can only be considered worthy of further study at this point. There were 47 patients in the treatment groups, a non-randomized before and after design with no blinding and other susceptibilities to bias. You know, maybe vitamin C will work. Maybe thiamine will work. Steroids are still controversial. Maybe there is a synergistic effect. But what's happened is, after this small publication with fewer than 100 patients and this glowing press release from the author's institution, we've actually seen some places suggest doing wholesale treatment change and practice change based on these patients. This desperately needs prospective validation, and while I hope for the best, I remain extraordinarily skeptical of their initial findings. Next up is urine culture follow-up and antimicrobial stewardship in a pediatric urgent care network. And this is from the Journal of Pediatrics. And I love this article because it's so simple, it makes sense, but it does take some extra effort from the clinicians. What this is all about is diagnosing urinary tract infections. We typically diagnose urinary tract infections based off the dipstick, patient symptoms, a urinalysis, or urine microscopy. But frequently, especially when the diagnosis is in question or there's other problems related to complications, you send off a urine culture. All these people did in their urgent cares is whenever one of those urine cultures came back negative, they called the parents and said, since this is a pediatric study, they called the parents and said, you don't need to take the antibiotics anymore. Your urine culture has come back negative. I think the antibiotics are more likely to be doing harm than good at this point. So in theory, what these authors report is that of the 8,648 days of antibiotics prescribed to the 910 patients in this study, this intervention obviated 3,429 days worth of antibiotic exposure, which is awesome. I mean, if you don't need to be on antibiotics, they are only going to harm you. They're going to change your gut flora. They're going to cause reactions. They're going to induce antibiotic resistance. If you don't need to be on them, you shouldn't be on them. Unfortunately, they don't really have good follow-up data to prove that they're safe or prove that their urine culture negative results were true negatives based on any kind of structured follow-up. Only 46 of these 910 patients subsequently sought care within their healthcare system within 14 days, and even though none of them had complications relating to a missed diagnosis of a urinary tract infection, this is hardly comprehensive follow-up. All that said, I think this is pretty reasonable patient-centered practice. If you can avoid harms to one of your patients by making a simple follow-up call, I think that's the right thing to do. The next article is called Direct Comparison of Four Very Early Rule-Out Strategies for Acute Myocardial Infarction Using High-Sensitivity Cardiac Troponin I, and this is from the Journal of Circulation. And high-sensitivity troponins are finally here. The FDA has approved the first one for use in the United States, so now articles like this are not purely for academic interest or for the rest of the world, which has had these for 7 years. So we're finally potentially going to start seeing the slow percolation of these assays into standard practice. But the main problem is these very sensitive assays are also less specific. So you have to have a sort of a comprehensive strategy for what to do with values that are either undetectable or less than the 99th percentile or in this indeterminate range, and how that all plays into your rapid rule-out protocol. Regardless, this is four different strategies compared that look at, you know, a 0 hour like limit of detection, a 0 hour 99th percentile cutoff, and 2 1-hour presentation and delta strategies. And basically, they all work out great. They miss a couple of what they would call acute MIs, but as they document in their sort of follow-up description of what these things they were that they missed, most of what they missed is tiny, didn't undergo any kind of revascularization procedure, and even though they call them acute MIs, a lot of their discharge diagnoses weren't even consistent with acute coronary syndromes. Furthermore, for those few patients that they did miss, there's a clear time-based element to rule out sensitivity, which we are all familiar with from conventional troponin and CKMB, which is why we've traditionally admitted these patients for observation. With these highly sensitive troponins, however, it looks like you're probably not going to miss anybody as long as they've had their chest pain for at least 2 hours or more. So in many ways, they will accelerate our disposition from the emergency department. But the main problem with these rule-out strategies, as documented in this paper, was that only about 50% of their patients were eligible for discharge at the end of their protocol. There is definitely room for improvement, however, because there was no risk stratification element to their protocol. It was just purely troponin-based. There was no heart score, no TIMI score, no accounting for previous MIs or any sort of risk factors, age, comorbidities. So I think this is a reasonable piece of evidence to incorporate into your protocol, as long as you're also adding in information about people who are at low pretest probability for acute coronary syndrome and sending them home, as well as the patients who successfully complete these protocols. And this next article is the 2017 ACC/AHA/HRS guideline for the evaluation and management of patients with syncope, and this is also published in Circulation. And this is something where I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail because it is one of those like 50-page documents from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology that talks about what are the reasonable sorts of things to do about syncope. And most of them go into the different options for downstream testing by cardiologists and the different indications for ventricular pacemakers and ablation procedures and different things like that. But there is a small element in here that talks about the initial evaluation and disposition of syncope. And thankfully, it gives us a ton of flexibility and doesn't mandate anything. It mandates, very insightfully, perform a history and physical examination. Perform a history and physical examination. I know this is a dying art, but they still recommend it. Then perform an electrocardiogram. And this has actually been suggested as a quality measure for the emergency department to perform EKGs on patients with syncope. So this is not surprising and not controversial. They also say that maybe you should use your brain and try and determine the cause of syncope and estimate short and long-term risk. Although there's no specific validated tool that's great at this, they do a brief summary of all the various rules and decision instruments people have tried to develop and then try and tease out some of the highest risk-presenting features. And then finally, they recommend don't send people home if you identify a serious medical cause. Very insightful and very useful, but what's great is they don't mandate any specific cardiac testing, no routine screening blood work, no specific imaging. And actually, they say that unless you find a specific indication for any of those tests, they're all likely of little or no value. And then it basically goes on to say that most patients with syncope never have a specific serious cause identified, and there's a wide range of possible disposition decisions, ranging from ED observation on a structured protocol to just nonspecific outpatient management. So while it doesn't provide much concrete guidance, it at least does not set any low-value medical legal precedent limiting your ability to make appropriate individual treatment decisions. Next up is the Prospective and Explicit Clinical Validation of the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale, with and without use of quantitative NT-proBNP. And this is one of those beautiful efforts from Canada to come up with a prognostication tool that's potentially valuable in the emergency department to determine patients at a high risk for serious adverse events after presenting to the emergency department with acute heart failure. This is a prospective observational derivation of a risk score, which they call, naturally, the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale. And it provides a prognostic range for serious adverse events ranging from 2.8% at the very low end of the scale up to 89% at the top of the scale. And this is based on 1,100 patients, 170 of whom suffered a serious adverse event in follow-up. The elements of their score are history of stroke or TIA gets 1 point. A history of intubation for respiratory distress gets 2 points. A heart rate on ED arrival of greater than 110 beats per minute gets 2 points. An oxygen saturation of less than 90% on EMS or ED arrival gets 1 point. An EKG with acute ischemic changes gets 2 points. And a blood urea nitrogen of greater than 12 millimoles per liter gets 1 point. So I think this is probably a reasonable decision instrument for risk stratifying your patients with acute heart failure, but where I think these authors take good work and make it less so is where they try to turn it into sort of a prescriptive mandate for observation or admission to the hospital. They try to make it into a decision instrument based on a cutoff of 2 points, and the reason I think this is sort of a foundational flaw is this presumption that admission to the hospital will be ultimately protective against some of these serious adverse events. Heart failure is way more complicated than just these six elements they've included for the decision instruments. And the reasons why patients might have a subsequent hospitalization or a subsequent adverse event are far more diverse than possibly could be prevented by just hospitalizing or observing somebody for a short period of time. So I think this is a really interesting informational tool to have at your fingertips to help you start having a conversation with the patient and their family about the next steps in their care. But whether they should actually just tie it to a dichotomous admission or discharge decision without taking into account all the other factors in play is probably erroneous. And lastly, I'm going to talk about the importance of urine concentration on the diagnostic performance of the urinalysis for pediatric urinary tract infection. And this is in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. This is actually a pretty simple one. If urine is more dilute, you're more likely to miss things. And vice versa, if urine is more concentrated, you're more likely to have false positives. So this is basically a retrospective analysis of 15,000 children for whom urinalyses and urine cultures were available. And it just looks at the number of white blood cells per high-powered field, leukocyte esterase, and nitrites as stratified by urine-specific gravity. There are 18 really dense tables with positive likelihood ratios, negative likelihood ratios, sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, negative predictive value, so on and so forth. The basic gist of the matter is as urine-specific gravity increases, it becomes more likely a patient will not have a positive urine culture despite having typically diagnostic amounts of white cells and leukocyte esterates and nitrites. And then likewise, with a dilute urine, a lower threshold of white blood cells per high power field may be needed to have an adequate sensitivity. It's quite fascinating to think about that for a simple test that we use ubiquitously, there is so much room for variability and individual interpretation of the urinalysis, and this is just one more layer of complexity. So that's everything from the month of March. I hope you've enjoyed this little episode. I'm still tracking to see if anybody's actually listening. And if you have any feedback, you know where to find me on the internet, either at emlitofnote.com or at emlitofnote on Twitter.